Well, hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. Thanks for tuning into another of our virtual events. And this afternoon, we have Kate Kavari joining us. She's going to be talking about her books, focusing on the brand new book, A Botanist's Guide to Flowers and Fatality. Let me see if I can hold this right. I always get confused. Is that right? Yeah. Beautiful cover. And Kate very kindly signed a batch of books for us. There we go. With a cool bookmark as well. I'll put a link in the comments field if you'd like to buy one of our signed copies. We also have copies of her earlier book. And if you have questions for Kate, go ahead and put them in and Barbara will bring me back on screen and I would be happy to ask any of them. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Kate, how nice to see you again. We had the pleasure of talking to Kate when A Botanist's Guide to Parties and Poisons published. Now, I have to say, Kate, this is A Botanist's Guide to Flowers and Fatality. I'm not sure how much longevity you've got for this kind of a title format. Or are you going to start running into problems?
I don't know. I'm a sucker for an alliteration. So I'm really hoping we can figure it out. We've been working on the title and cover art for the third mystery, which comes out next year. And we've been, you know, playing with some words, trying to figure out how to make the alliteration keep working. But I love it. So I'm happy to work on it.
Well, no, I like alliteration too. I just didn't think there's an infinite life. The other thing that's interesting too is that mystery titles, as a general rule, crime novels like short titles. And this is a fairly long one. But
it's a mouthful.
That you get to have these really lovely cover designs to go with it. And the title, you know, is part of it. And since our focus here to a large part is in fact on herbs and flowers and, you know, flora, it seems to work really well. So Kate, what got you interested in, you know, the whole sort of poison world, the whole herbal, because a lot of it's actually a good world. A lot of it's a healing world.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've learned through researching the second book and getting the third book ready in particular, is that anything poisonous is actually probably also a medicine and vice versa. So you have too much of anything and it's going to hurt you. You have just the right amount and you'll be fine. But I got interested just because I love gardening. I love plants. When I first got married and we got our first apartment, our entire living room was chock full of plants. And now we have a house and it's still chock full of plants. So we have like a jungle room, living room, my office is full of plants, but I just think that they are fascinating, but like quietly fascinating. And it's even cooler that all of these plants that exist, you know, across time and cultures have been used as medicine, but also as poison.
But you're absolutely right. It's really learning to administer to the quantities. I mean, digitalis is a good thing. If you have a weak heart, it can stimulate it. And it's a fatal thing if you get too much of it. And that is true with an astonishing amount. And, you know, I shouldn't even bring this up in this particular climate, but there have been things like Poldark. If anybody remembers watching Poldark, there's a whole thing about abortifacients or fashions, however you pronounce that word. You know, our plants were used for various purposes that, you know, today we use other drugs for, but could be powerful. You should read Lisa C's new book that just came out this week, Lady Tan and Her Circle of Women.
Are there poisons in it?
Well, there's a whole plant and poison thing. Yeah, absolutely. And the other, you know, kind of key element of your books is how difficult it was for women to, you know, practice any sort of medical or pharmaceutical profession. In your case, the 1920s. In her case, we're back in the Tang Dynasty in the 15th century. You know, it was considered kind of a male province, but the truth is women had generally been better at all of this over the centuries, if you look at it, or if not better at it, at least more familiar with it. Maybe that would be a fairer statement.
Yeah. I mean, for centuries, it was, you know, like the I don't know what they call them, you know, like the witch woman that you go to and she solves your problem with herbs. And I feel like that's also kind of why, out of all of the sciences, I feel like botany was kind of not welcoming. I wouldn't call it welcoming, but I would say more accepted as an interest for, you know, gentle women going into the 20th century, you know, like women in general. But yeah, it's because it's plants and plants are pretty. And they thought like, okay, well, that's fine. If the girl wants to play with flowers, then that's fine. But really what they were doing was building catalogs of knowledge about what plants could do.
But, you know, it was part of women's training when running households, especially, you know, large ones, but I mean, back for forever, women were trained to look after the people in their household and administer medicines and so forth to them. There was, you know, the still room. I know one of the Jane Austen mysteries that Stephanie Barron wrote is called Jane and the Still Room Maid, because, you know, this is a place where women concocted not just medicines, but also, you know, household products, you know, cleaning products and, you know, hygienic products and all that other sort of stuff. But it was a mostly a female role.
I wonder if that's where the notion of poison being like the province of female murderers came from, because they would know, they would have all of that knowledge and they have access to like give it to people.
I think it's true. And, you know, let's remember that Agatha Christie, for example, you know, her work was as in pharmacology in the war. So poisons are what she did. Ellis Peters in her wonderful Brother Cadvale medieval series, she was also a person who, like Christie, worked in pharmacology in the war. Hilariously, Dorothy Sayers, who didn't work in pharmacology, got her poison wrong in the only book she used in which poison was the murder weapon.
I'm gonna have to go back and find that one. I love the Daisy Dalrymple series. They're so cute. I'm gonna have to go back and find the poison.
I'll try to, it'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, it revolves around poison mushrooms and she got the mushroom wrong. Her mycology was wrong. But then as I say, she was an academic that hadn't actually worked in that field. So Saffron, I think, is a really interesting woman. Is she somebody that have you modeled her on somebody, or is she your own creation?
She's definitely my own creation. And I think that's only because when I started writing these books, I was writing them for fun. I'd never written a book. I didn't plan on doing anything with this project. I was just like, can I write a mystery? And I just started writing. And so I didn't have like the education to be able to model her after anybody. And it's only really in the past, you know, couple years trying to get the books published and doing more research that I'm realizing that like, she was one of like legion women in botany, even in the 1920s. But I mean, at Saffron's particular university, there's a reason why she is the only woman, which is gone over in book one. And it's because her boss was a misogynistic jerk. So no woman wanted to work there, but she is one of many. So if I had known that at the time, I probably would have tried to find a more specific person to model her after. But I kind of like that she's just a new creation as well, because I feel like there's a little bit more pressure to bring in more details of like, you know, whoever you're modeling off, you know, their life and trying to be true to that person. And I can just make Saffron up entirely this way.
It's very hard for women to, you know, be accepted in professional circles. And I'm trying to think, I wanted to say it was Gillian Cantor, but I'm trying to remember who it was because I did an event with her. Anyway, her book was about a woman who was very interested, and it might have been in relation to the double helix. There was a woman who was part of the sort of unsung heroine of the Crick and Watson double helix discovery. And they used a lot of her science in order to, in fact, you know, create the double helix model. And she was able to be accepted and do a lot of her work in France, but the British had a much more chauvinistic attitude about women in science. And so, you know, she didn't get the credit and the respect she deserves. So, you know, it sort of makes sense to me that in 1920s London, that it would be difficult for Saffer and Eversley to have an entree and be respected as part of this faculty that she, you know, where she's engaged.
Exactly. And I think the thing that I'm realizing is that there were many women in the workforce after the war, obviously, they were kind of trickling out, but there was a lot of women who wanted to stay. And they fought for it and they stayed, but like you said, they didn't get the recognition and the respect. So we had women in all different kinds of fields doing all different kinds of things, but you will not find their name in history books. You will find them as a footnote, if even that, a lot of times. And there were well-respected women who published and got some recognition, but for every one of those, how many hundreds will never know that they were scientists and what they discovered.
Yep. So you're at University College in London, which is a real place. And Saffron Eversley, whom we're talking about here, is a, quote, research assistant. So tell us, because a lot of people may not have read A Botanist's Guide to Parties and Poisons. You want to go back and kind of root. Oh, there's Patrick being helpful. It was Marie Benedict. Thank you. And her Hidden Genius was the one that wrote about the whole DNA, the whole double helix thing. Thank you, Patrick. See, that's one thing that happens when you get as old as I am. You have some trouble remembering names. So the chat feature on Zoom is wonderful.
It's very helpful.
It's very helpful. They can go look it up and remind me, so we can, you know, get that information out there. I love that book, by the way, Her Hidden Genius. I don't know if you've read it, but you might want to think about it in terms of what your own, you know, not to copy it, but just because the situations are similar.
Yeah, for sure. I love women scientists, fictional and non-fictional.
Anyway, back to University College and Saffron Eversley and A Botanist's Guide to Parties and Poisons. How do we meet Saffron?
So we meet Saffron as she is entering a dinner party she really doesn't want to go to, because her colleagues will be there and she needs to network and she doesn't want to because they don't like her and she doesn't really like them all that much. So she's going, and at this dinner party, there is a expedition that is going to take place where a bunch of her colleagues are going to the Amazon rainforest to do research. She is not going and she's bummed, but everyone is there to celebrate this. And the man who's going to lead the expedition, his wife collapses, and later they find out from the police that she's been poisoned. So Saffron and a handful of other party guests become suspects, including Saffron's mentor and like kind of pseudo father figure at the university, Dr. Maxwell. He catches most of the blame. And so she is eager to take him out of the picture and say, like, obviously he's not the bad guy. And she does this by investigating who poisoned Mrs. Henry and why by herself. And so we meet her through that. We meet her reluctant co-sleuth, Alexander Ashton, who is also a love interest. And they spend the book making mischief as they go through gardens and greenhouses trying to find the answer to who poisoned Mrs. Henry.
Right. And there's an act of real personal bravery, which we won't discuss any further. But I thought that was a really courageous thing for you to do in that book. It makes it an exciting.
Or stupid? That's the question.
No, it wasn't stupid at all. I think, you know, it's easy to make some historical fiction, particularly with women, it's easy to make it maybe a little too pretty, a little too soft, more like romance. I mean, no, not a rom-com necessarily, but because, I mean, relationships are important in books like this. But I think too often men get the credit for being physically brave, and you know, good for Saffron that she has that, she takes that risk. I really like that.
Yeah.
A very meaningful part of your book. So yeah. Have you had other feedback about it? We can't really talk about what it is, but have you had in the way of reading?
I had I had one reader who was incredibly helpful tell me that Saffron was maybe being a little too stupid to live, which I think is fair feedback in that case. But I mean, people love that Saffron is willing to take risks for those that she cares about. And they also love that she makes mistakes. And that's probably my favorite thing about Saffron, is that she makes questionable choices at times. And sometimes they're because she just wants to find the answer. She's a scientist, like finding the answer and putting together puzzles is her thing. And so she is eager to do that sometimes in an unsafe way, but she also learns from it, which is, I think, really what we see in Flowers and Fatality, is that she has grown and changed as a person. She's still, you know, out there like investigating murders when she is not trained or qualified to do that, but she is going about it in a slightly smarter way this time. I don't say in the like the smartest way, because the smartest way would be not to investigate a murder. But you know, that's like what she feels called to do, because she sees an injustice and she sees a wrong that she feels she can help right, and she wants to do that. So that's one of the things that I like about her.
Well, there are many things to like about her, but let's remember too that you're in really early days of forensic medicine. I mean, sorry, you know, forensics in general. And yeah. I mean, there were undoubtedly hundreds, thousands of deaths by poison that were not detected because they're, you know, over centuries, because there really weren't the tools to do that, or maybe the inclination to do it.
I read an incredible nonfiction book last year. I think it's by Deborah Blum. I'm not sure how to say her name. But I think it's called The Poisoner's Handbook, mm-hmm. or something like that. And it's all about the development of like forensic medicine. And they spend a lot of time on poison. So obviously, like, I saw Poisoner's Handbook and I'm like, well, this is mine. I'm reading this. And I really treat it like a little bit of a Bible. I have lots of markings because it's incredibly helpful for me as a writer. But for me, just learning about the process of like how they developed all of these things, and the incredible amount of time and concentration and just like relentless pursuit of science that these people had. It was a very small group. And I mean, people were doing it all over the world, but this particular book focuses on how they developed it in New York City in the teens and the 20s and the 30s. And it was just incredible. And so after reading that, I'm like, I understand why poisoning was so popular, like through the 1800s into the 1900s, because it was so hard to detect. Exactly. And to like make a case for.
And it mimicked real illness. I mean, you know, ours, mm-hmm. you know, largely mimicked, you know, stomach illness or whatever it was. And without a really decent test for arsenic, I think lots of deaths were written off, you know. And then also because people didn't have like pharmacies to go to, sometimes people accidentally poisoned themselves. Again, mm-hmm. you know, as we were saying earlier, because there wasn't any real standards about, I mean, easily available standards yeah. about dosage and so forth. So
that reminds me, there's a really great Poirot where the person dies because they didn't shake up their like nightly tonic and all this strychnine had floated to the bottom and they took the last dose and they died because they didn't shake it up every day. So, I mean, it's stuff like that. Like, and not to mention that they gave people crazy stuff. Like cocaine was like a medicine, right? For a long time. And that's actually mentioned in Flowers and Fatality, because there is a cocaine connection, and they talk about a little bit about the history of how it eventually became regulated, like after the war and like during the war and all that kinds of stuff. It's just so fascinating. I could just talk forever about it because it's so cool. And I guess that's what makes me like the person who decided to write these books, is because I hear about this and I'm like, okay, well, that is fascinating. And I want to write about that.
Well, you know, if you were to go to Cusco, let's say in Peru, when you walked into the major hotels, what you would find is they're giving you cocaine in the lobby because they have coca tea that they brew for mm-hmm. you, because it helps your system acclimate to the higher altitude. You know, it's a stimulant.
So, yeah, it's, again, they use it like medicine, right?
Well, it is medicine. It's exactly right. But then again, as you point out, if you overdo it, you know, there you are. But anyway, all of that aside, I think the really interesting thing about Saffron is the way that she is carving out a role for her in a place in a professional milieu that is not friendly to women. So in this book, she is going to start on her first research study, or the British say research, they don't say research, so we have to get it right. Her first research study alongside the insufferably charming Dr. Michael Lee. I love that phrase. So why is he insufferably charming? Why isn't he just a jerk like the rest of them?
Well, he's charming and he knows it. And we all know that kind of person who, you know, they are a peacock and they love being like handsome and charming and whatever. But the reason why Lee is not 100% a jerk is because he is a doctor. He's a medical doctor that Saffron has been paired with on her first study. And he loves being a doctor. He is passionate about it. And so we get to see his positive traits right away because the opening scene is there at the scene of a poisoning. And so we know that he cares desperately about his patients. Even though he is willing to like flirt and laugh, you know, kind of on the sidelines, he cares about his science just like Saffron does. And then as we get further into the book, we see him start to understand what it's like for her at the university. And he starts to understand that there's a reason why with him, she's kind of tight-lipped and snarky instead of, you know, falling at his feet like all the other women do. And it's because life is really hard for her as a woman at the university. And so, I don't know, we see him have his own little arc of understanding through the book. And so that's part of the reason why I love him. He's really fun to write, but he's also like, he's a decent guy underneath all the charm and the smiles.
What was the romantic interest in the first book?
Alexander Ashton. And he comes back to play in this book as well.
Right, because he's off stage. He's like off in the Amazon or returning from the Amazon as it starts. So, you know, Mary Stewart, who wrote absolutely wonderful books of romantic suspense. I mean, she was absolutely brilliant 50 years ago and more of those books were huge. She always had two men and one woman.
Classic love triangle.
Well, it was a little different because she was writing romantic suspense. And so the puzzle for the reader, she was great on, you know, countryside. She even did a lot of flora, a lot of botany, a lot of history, a lot of other stuff. But the crux of the plot was always going to be which of them was the true guy and which of them was a wolf in disguise, so to speak. And, you know, you three had to try to work out which one of them to trust or which one of them, you know, she was going to eventually be able to trust. And so it's always interesting when you bring in not your guy from Brazil right back, you know, to start to introduce the insufferably charming Dr. Michael Lee. So now there are potentially two suitors in play should Saffron actually have time for romance. Yeah.
That's a very good point. Girl's really busy. So yeah, I don't know what she's going to do to find time for these guys. That's a good point. But yeah, I mean, it was not like a plan to have these two guys, but the more I got to know Lee, the more I understood that like, he has some things that he could offer Saffron that Alexander also offers, but maybe struggles with as well, which we see when he comes back from the Amazon. He is in this book, by the way, in case you're wondering. I have a lot of people who have been asking because they love Alexander. And right. Yes, he does come back.
Excellent. Well, and the other, you know, problem that Saffron would be facing was that, you know, people who married back in this time and, you know, had sex, otherwise why get married, and therefore often got pregnant, you know, that could put paid to a profession or could create a whole question about, you know, childcare and whether you can put yourself at risk. I mean, that's been a chronic problem with women investigators in the amateur sleuth level is, you know, what's the morality of a woman with young children or a baby putting herself at risk investigating a crime? So
well, I've
that's a whole thing she might not want to do.
Yeah, I've really thought about that because I think about, you know, where are these Saffron books going to go? Where is it going to go with whichever guy she ends up with? But yeah, I mean, those are questions that I want her to struggle with and I want her to grapple with but also as a scientist, right? Her career will be impacted when you're, you know, a researcher, you have names on a paper. And if you got married in the 1920s, there was no hyphenating. There was no keeping your maiden name. You were going to take your husband's name. So any credit that S. Everly would get would change to whoever she ends up with. So that's something that she's going to be thinking about.
That's true. The Married Women's Property Act did not protect you in that respect. You know, there was, I think, I'm trying to remember if Britain didn't enact the Married Woman Property Act before the Seneca Falls and the Married Women Property Act here in this country.
I'm not sure when they did, but I'm just talking about like her name, like in her professional.
Oh, I know you are, but that's an extension is what I'm thinking here. It's kind of an extension of the Married Women's Property Act is that even if women gain the right to, you know, own their own stuff and their own income and so forth, as you point out, people did give up their maiden names, and therefore there wasn't really any way to continue that. I mean, that's an interesting point I hadn't thought about, so I thank you for bringing that up.
No problem.
No, it is. So what is the research project that Saffron is undertaking?
She and Lee have been assigned a series of case studies in which they are attending like local poisoning. So they get a report of a poisoning and they immediately go to wherever it's happening, kind of in the very like local London and like, you know, maybe like an hour or two outside of London. And Lee goes as the doctor and he can help with the treatment, but also he's getting like blood samples and things to see how it affects them. And then Saffron is in charge of finding the culprit if they don't know what it is and then getting the plant samples. And we find out late in the book why they're doing this and who gave them this assignment. So I won't give that away, but it's basically just a series of case studies where they are documenting local poisons and really carefully documenting their effects. Because even at this time, I mean, we've had like, you know, 1,000 years or more of like written botany texts, but you know, there's very little information, like concrete kind of guidebooks about what like poisonous plants do, like consistently do, what are the toxins and all that kind of thing. So that's kind of, they're making kind of like a catalog or a database of that.
Got it. So in order to be a successful amateur sleuth, you have to have some actual police person, somebody with policing powers involved. Mm-hmm. It isn't going to be Saffron and Dr. Lee because they are not in law enforcement. So who in fact is Detective Inspector Green and what role is he playing?
Detective Inspector Green, he is the kind of long-suffering detective who I feel like when I picture him, I really picture Foyle from Foyle's War. Like, just like you look at him and you're like, you're kind of tired. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're doing, but you're tired because, you know, he's involved in crime in a big city and he's in charge of solving it. So he's kind of the older, almost mentor kind of guy. In the first book, he was more, not quite, like, he wasn't like a menace, right? Because obviously he's trying to solve a murder. But they had much more of an antagonistic relationship, right? Because Saffron was doing things that she was not supposed to do. So in this book, he has come to her and asked her to consult. And then she gets kind of overexcited and says, I will solve this crime. And so she goes off with Lee. And she's working to use their connections in society to solve the crime. But yeah, he's just kind of like old hand at crime solving. And we also get to see Sergeant Simpson comes back, who is kind of a little bit like a puppy following the inspector around and tripping over things. But yeah, so I mean, we get kind of the best of both worlds. We get a bumbling sergeant and we get like an actual decent police officer.
Well, we have to have him. You know, all the Golden Age mysteries, there was always, you know, Miss Marple had her nephew, Poirot had Inspector Japp, you know, Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes had Lestrade. You know, there has to be, as I said, there has to be for enthusiastic amateur sleuths are all well and good, but there has to, at the end of the day, there has to be somebody with the legal authority to, you know, to deal with things. With Poirot, I'm trying to remember. His buddy is Colonel Hastings, but who's
Hastings.
But
he's the bumbling one for sure. Although Japp also is kind of bumbling at times.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, so it's a dual thing. And you may not remember this, Kate, because you're younger, but back in the 90s there was a huge movement called the Woman Sleuth Movement, which was powered by Sue Grafton and Sarah Paretsky and Marsha Muller and whatever. And basically what they were was private investigators, privatized, and, you know, solving cases. But again, there always had to be, and it was usually male, though it didn't actually have to be because there were women in law enforcement at that point, but there always had to be somebody who could actually, in the end of the, you know, at the end of the whole thing, arrest somebody. So, you know, that constant thing. I mean, all amateur sleuths books really do need a professional at some point, a professional law enforcement person, or justice is never going to happen unless you decide that the amateur sleuth is just going to be a vigilante and, you know, execute whoever it might happen to be.
Yeah. I don't see Saffron doing that personally.
No, and it kind of goes against, you know, if the amateur sleuth, the idea of the amateur sleuth is, you know, also the executioner doesn't really play very well. So so there we have Inspector Green. So, and by that time, by the 1920s, there was an established police force in England and in London. If you're writing historical mystery in the Regency period, for example, which is having a renaissance, or as the British say, renaissance, thanks to Bridgerton and whatever, the police, there wasn't an official police force. You had Bow Street runners, but they were sort of quasi-professional, and you had magistrates, but you didn't really have any actual formal police until the 1830s. So
yeah, well, and even then, like it was not like good police. Like they were so corrupt that I think in the 1890s, 1880s, they had a big cleanup. And maybe it was even later. I'm not really sure, but I've researched it just like a tiny bit, for like a one liner that Simpson says at some point. But like they had police, but like they weren't good. They weren't like real police until much, much later.
And then today we have Call of Duty, which reminds us of just how corrupt modern police force actually is. So, you know, that's always been a problem. And in point of fact, the amateur sleuths are generally, there's no real stench of corruption around amateur sleuths. You know, you don't, I mean, True Saffron was a suspect in the first book. Although we knew she was innocent, or otherwise, why would we be reading the book? But in general, the amateur sleuths are not stigmatized with the thought of corruption.
Yeah, well, it's because they're choosing, because they have some kind of chip on their shoulder, some kind of motivation that they are choosing to do this thing. Whereas, you know, with police, like it's a job. I'm sure a lot of police officers like do it because they want justice, but it's also a job and they get a paycheck and that whole thing.
But amateur sleuths, or at least, you know, somebody like Saffron, is usually sleuthing because they have some kind of expertise. A consultant in a way, if you want to look at it that way. And oftentimes they become engaged in whatever the case is, because there's some personal stake. Somebody is at risk, somebody they care about, could even be themselves. And so, you know, they're engaged in trying to get to the real truth of the matter and not just sit back and accept an obvious verdict. you know, so there's a lot of motivations that go on. What are there any particular poisons that you can mention in this book, or is it going to be spoilers if we talk about what's in play?
I can't talk about the actual poisons, but I can talk about the bouquets, because the premise of the book is that the crime that Inspector Green has been tasked with solving involves several murdered women who have received bouquets. And then he brings the bouquets to Saffron, who says, "Can you tell me anything about these? They might be a clue." And so she realizes that multiple of the flowers used and the plants used are dangerous. They're poisonous, or they'll cause like dermatitis or whatever on the hands or wherever. And so digging a little deeper, she realizes that the bouquets are actually sending a message, and she decodes that message with like a vintage, like Victorian era floriography dictionary. Because of something Lee kind of says on a whim, and she's like, wait, like that was a thing at some point. So she goes and she finds out that the bouquets have had, they've been sending a message, and the messages are kind of violent ones. And so they do realize that it's a clue. And so Saffron takes those clues and tries to figure out what they say about the murders. So we have like, Aconite makes a reappearance after the first book. Aconite was a part of that. And so we have that coming back. We have Foxglove, which you mentioned, Digitalis earlier. I actually have all of the flowers that are used in the bouquets on the bookmark. So if you're able to go in person to Poisoned Pen and you see a signed copy, it has a bookmark in it. And the bookmark lists all of the plants that are in the bouquets and their floriography meaning. So that's cool. And you can also find it. You can find those same things. I don't remember the name of the book exactly. I think it's just called The Language of Flowers. And I found that online because I just Googled floriography dictionary. And that was the first one that I found. So if you are like me and want to know more about floriography, the book that I used is Flowers, Their Language, Poetry, and Sentiment. It was published in 1870. So anyway, if you're interested in floriography, that is a first resource that you can see. But floriography also is kind of having a renaissance. I've seen a lot of bookstores are carrying floriography books now, which is really cool.
It is cool. And yeah, it was a really big Victorian thing. It was a way to send messages. You know, it was a courtship thing. It was a lover's language. You know, you could, a young woman could, you know, receive a bouquet, you know, send flowers, and it could have, because of floriography, it could have a specific message in it. You know, that's an interesting idea. I don't think that I've really thought about carrying. I know we have, you know, the language of poisons or whatever it was. What was the title we referred to earlier?
Oh,
the ones
you asked me too quick.
I'm sorry, the one in Old New York. Anyway, yes, that, you know, the
Poisoner's Handbook.
The Poisoner's Handbook, thank you. Right, that in their Poison Pen Press, actually years ago, there was an Italian who put together a really interesting, I can't remember the title of it either, but it was like a dictionary of poisons, or, you know, something more. And of course, then there's always the question of, you know, when people go to check out a book like that, are they just reading it for fun, or is this going to be a how to do it manual? Or, you know,
that's what my husband says every time I buy one of these books. He's like, anybody who looks on our bookshelf is going to have questions. And then I'll just point to like all my books on the bookshelf. And I'm like, there's the answer. That's why we have all of these books about poisons and murder, is because I write books about it.
Well, there are poison gardens. And, you know, I had someone in the store the other day who actually has a poison garden. And we were talking about it. I asked her if she had and she said, you know, because oleander is like hedging here. I mean, there are oleander hedges all over, certainly all over Scottsdale, and I think all over Metro Phoenix, and they're beautiful in the spring. I mean, the profusion of blooms, and they're gorgeous magenta and white. And anyway, but very, very poisonous. And the woman with the poison garden said that she didn't want oleander because it was so, not just the flowers, but I think the wands, whatever it all is. Anyway, it was too dangerous.
Well, and it poisons honey. Like if bees it take too much pollen from it, then the honey can become poisonous.
That's exactly right. It's also very bad for pets. I mean, if you have, but there are other, even cacti. We had one of our puppies went leaping into the pencil cactus, for example, and the sap of it is just harsh enough that it burned his eye. He had it didn't kill him, but so we had to rush him to the midnight vet, to have his eyes out, and he had to wear the cone, and it was horrible. So we dug up the pencil cactus because he liked jumping into it, and we put it in a pot where he can't reach it. So I mean, there are many hostile plants that maybe aren't directly poisonous, but in their own defense, particularly cacti.
Yes.
Have either vicious thorns or dangerous sap or whatever it might happen to be, just as kind of a defense for the plant itself. But gardening is such a British thing, and I think there are poison gardens all over Britain, a lot of it.
I visited, I went to London in October, I went to a lot of places related to my books. I went to the University College campus, and I went to Kew Gardens, which was incredible. But I also went to, there's this little tiny garden in Chelsea. It's called the Chelsea Physic Garden. And it is, I think, it's either the oldest apothecary garden in Europe or in England. I'm not really sure which one. But just this little tiny garden, and it's beautiful, but it is chock full of poisonous stuff because, I feel like this is the point we keep coming back to. It's that like all things poison can also be medicine, right?
Yeah.
But it was really fun because even though it was very late in the season, they still had like some aconite blooming. They had like foxglove and all this other kind of stuff. But oleander is one I think about all the time. We have a guy on our street who has oleander growing. And every time we pass by it, I tell my son, who is now 4, don't touch that, that's poisonous. Every time we go to the gardening section at Home Depot or Lowe's, I say, don't touch that, don't touch that, don't touch that. Just because I've learned so much from researching these books that there's literally poisonous stuff everywhere.
There really is. If you have dogs, for example, you have to learn that poinsettia and geranium are very bad for dogs. So, if you're at Christmas, you have to really think seriously about whether you want to have like a floor stand poinsettia, if you have eager puppies and stuff. So not all poisons are poisonous to all things, you have to keep that in mind. Well, let's wind up by talking about book 3. I always like asking if, in fact, there's a new book, but since you brought it up, obviously there is going to be a new book. So how exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And we actually just signed with Crooked Lane for a fourth book for 2025. So there's more saffron and more poisons coming. But book three is going to be a little bit different. We're moving to a different research facility. Saffron is still at the university, but she's going to see another research facility with some women there, which will be fun for her. But I just don't even know what to say about this book. It's so much fun. there's brothers involved. We get to see Alexander's brother is involved in the book. Elizabeth's brother is going to be in that book as well. So very interesting family relationships and family dynamics. So we get to know everybody a lot better because we get to see more about their families, which is really fun.
So for a person who just sort of wondered if she could write a mystery, you've certainly taken to this like as the proverbial duck to water.
Yeah, it was really like turning on a hose and then just like a geyser erupted instead. I've always really loved reading and writing, but I never thought that I would be a writer like professionally, but I don't know. I have so many ideas and so little time. So I'm excited to keep going.
Well, that's wonderful news. I certainly have enjoyed both your books. And I meant to tell you that we have the Arizona Herb Society's 10th anniversary meeting at the Poison Pen this coming Sunday. And one of our staff is put together a bibliography and assembled a bunch of books, you know, to talk about. And so our few remaining signed copies are part of this. So it'll be interesting. He's going to spread the word among the actual herbalists.
I know, but see, now I'm scared because my greatest fear is that I've made a mistake and some gardener somewhere is going to be like, that's not what actually is going on.
That's all right. You can refer them back to Dorothy Sayers. She managed it very well.
True.
And, well, Patrick, come join us while you are looking for questions online or something. I'm going to look up the Dorothy Sayers book when in fact she got it all wrong.
Yeah. Now, when I first started when I returned to reading, I took, like a lot of people, I got really turned off of reading in high school and college because I wasn't into the literature that they made us read.
Yeah.
And so I came back to it and I read like all the Freddie Fisher books. I read a lot of Tasha Alexander and I read like 15 or 20 of the Carola Dunn Daisy books. But I haven't read them like in years. So now I'm like, did I read that one? I don't remember.
There's a new Franny Fisher book coming out this year by Carrie. Yay, which is great. And Tasha will be with us on October 22nd. And Lady Emily and Colin have gone to Egypt. So that'll be
I love the travel books are the best. I love travel books. I love like the Poirot's where he goes to like there's like Death on the Nile and Murder in Mesopotamia. Like those are my favorites. They're so much fun.
Well, just mark down October 22nd and you'll be able to watch Tasha talk about that. Patrick, are there any questions?
There are some nice comments. You know, how cool that she uses Victorian flower symbolism to solve the mystery.
Oh.
Robin says, I'm listening to Diana Gabaldon's eighth book where Claire is visiting a huge garden outside Philadelphia. There's a ton of plant information in that in her books. Yeah.
There it is. All right. It's the documents in the case. I knew I could find it.
Documents in the case.
The documents in the case by Dorothy Sayers. It's without Lord Peter.
Oh, right. I was getting my authors mixed up.
Yep, a noted expert on fungi is found dead after digesting poisonous mushrooms. So it's mycology that was in play. There's a world of accidental poisoning because you don't know your mushrooms.
Yeah.
You can easily
we are going to see some mycology in Saffron number 3, which is very amusing to me because she has to consistently tell someone, I'm not a mycologist. It is not the same thing.
Right. And as I understand it, that particular poisonous mushroom, the name of which, of course, I can't fully remember, there is no way to reverse it. If you eat it, you're dead. There isn't any way. There's no way to fix it when it happens to you. So, you know.
There are a lot of plants that have psychedelic properties, too.
There sure are.
Yeah. And cacti, succulents.
Yeah.
Ooh, see, that's dangerous because succulents and cacti are so tempting when you're in desperate need of water.
Right. Grab the wrong one.
You can.
Some peyote and who knows where you're going to go.
And what is it that didn't Oregon just agree that people could take magic mushrooms? I think they just legalized, psychedelic mushrooms, if I remember this right.
Like recreationally?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it might be medicinally, but I think recreationally. I mean, you know, states are moving into cannabis Arizona, you know, has made it legal. I think whatever this is in Oregon, I'm pretty sure I'm right. I'll look it up. Oregon, that's the great thing about having a phone. There's hardly anything you can't look up. That Oregon.
Toads secrete that, you know. What is it I can't remember the name of the, is it Bufo, something like that, that those crazy kids are all doing these days?
Licking
a toad and
one mystery that I think Saffron will not be investigating. That one right here. Alexander might, though. Alexander is a biologist, so maybe he can bring that up.
Okay, Oregon approves the final leak in the legal psychedelic mushroom pipeline on May 23rd. They are officially the first state in the nation with a functioning legal system to obtain and use psilocybin. So, you know, who knows how much.
Also the whole notion of microdosing, I think, has really been helpful in a lot of medicinal applications. Yeah. I mean, not just tripping, you know, but for different things.
Right. Well, cannabis is known to relieve a lot of pain for cancer patients and people right. with other, you know, and the CBC stuff, you know, external applications are great for arthritis and other kinds of things. So, you know, it's interesting that in a way, you know, we're kind of moving back to the old, you know, herbal remedies and so forth that our ancestors depended on. In fact, reading about Lisa C's book, Lady Tan, which I mentioned to you, which is absolutely fabulous, some of the medicines and practices that Lady Tan is using in the Tang Dynasty are still in practice in China today. So, you know, their efficacy has lasted for centuries. So it isn't all. In fact, as I understand it too, there's a constant sort of looking in the Amazon for stuff, you know, that in whatever parts of the rainforest still exists, which might turn out to have miraculous powers for various ailments. So,
yeah, the plants, but also the fungi in particular, I think are of most interest to them. Yeah. At the moment, and they're realizing like 40% of the rainforest has been destroyed or something like that, and now they're saying, well, that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of organisms that we could have used for medicine, and so like how many remedies for cancer have been destroyed and things like that.
Or conversely, how much has been let loose on the world that, you know, was previously locked up in the rainforest? So there's the dark side to that as well. Yeah, and that's going to be true as glaciers melt. I mean, I know I read something, and I can't remember if it was real or if it was part of a mystery or something, but under the permafrost in Siberia, something thawed out, and whatever the plague germs were that had been frozen there have come to life. So, you know, there.
I've definitely read, I think that might be in Whiteout. I think there's a romantic thriller that I read like last summer, the summer before, when it was really hot and I wanted something cool to read, where they had found some kind of germ or bacteria like in the ice when they drilled down. And so these big bads like came to steal it and sell it basically. But I feel like this is also something that's actually happening in the world and not just in romantic thrillers.
Well, I think it's actually possible. And another big question is, you know, in former plagues, people were buried in plague pits because there was no way to deal with, you know, hundreds or thousands of bodies and all. And so a real question is, has any of that bacteria survived buried down there in the plague pit? And, you know, if it thaws out or whatever it might be, is it going to leap out again? And, you know, so there, you know, you're so right that the whole question with all of this comes back to balance, you know, the good part, the benefits, as opposed to the dangers and, you know, deficits of the floral world.
Yeah. And it's a great metaphor for, you know, mystery writers, is that like everyone has positive characteristics, but any characteristic, when there's too much of it, is going to cause problems. So
absolutely true. Well, it's been a joy to talk to you again, Kate. One of these days you must come and see us.
I want to so bad. Are you kidding?
Well,
the name of the bookstore alone,
well, of course,
makes that it incredibly tempting for me.
I'm actually toying with putting together a little thing with Tasha at that weekend in October, because there's a new Jane Austen, a final Jane Austen mystery. C.S. Harris has another, maybe, you know, a little historicon, as we call it. So if I get that organized,
yes,
it would be, you know, maybe half a dozen authors, and we could do like a whole afternoon. So I'll stay in touch because it's a shame we haven't had a chance to meet you, even though I've really enjoyed our two Zoom sessions. So here we go. A Botanist's Guide to Floral and Fatality, which we have autographed in the paperback of A Botanist's Guide to Parties and Poisons, is just out. So that'll give you a chance to get started on this wonderful series. So thank you, Kate, for your time, and thank you for watching us. Bye.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.